travelers, and welcome to Adventures in Security, episode 18 for March 19th, 2006, with your host, Tom Olzak. This is a weekly podcast published each Sunday evening sometime before midnight. You can find the information covered in our episodes at adventuresinsecurity.com/blog. If you're interested in commenting on what you hear or about topics you'd like us to talk about, please send email to podcasts@adventuresinsecurity.com. In today's episode, I'm talking about the security and privacy issues related to using RFID tags, as well as the challenges and the protection steps you can take when dealing with DNS cache poisoning. But first, I'd like to comment on Google's purchase of Rightly. For those of you not familiar with Rightly, it's an online, beta, word processing service that provides the following services. You can create documents online. You can upload documents from Word. You can publish to the web. You can post to your blog. And you can participate in online collaboration with people you specify. Yep, it's a great product with fantastic potential. And now that Google has purchased the company, Upstartle, things could get very interesting. There's just one catch. There are no safeguards to protect the content of documents during editing or viewing. On February 27, 2006, in the Rightly blog, Jen, an employee of Upstartle, responded to a thread in which users questioned why SSL protection was not provided. I quote, "Okay, now I have to reply. We don't have SSL definitely planned as part of a premium service, although that's certainly possible. SSL will definitely slow the service down, which is why we would likely not make it the default in the basic service. Yes, I know this response is vague, but it's only because our plans are not final." End quote. As I posted to the Rightly blog, it's irresponsible for an organization to provide a tool like this without any apparent regard for safeguarding the activities of its users. I hope that Google takes a different approach with this innovative and, in my opinion, much needed service. Okay, now that I got that off my chest, let's move on to RFID tags. The advantages inherent in RFID tags are moving these very small devices into prevalence as tracking and identification devices. Simplicity of use, the ability to uniquely identify tagged entities, and the promise of low-cost implementation make them a suitable replacement for the venerable barcode. But the barcode has two advantages the RFID tag lacks. It can't insert malware into your network, and it can't be used to invade the privacy of unsuspecting consumers. In this episode, we'll explore the technology behind RFID tags, why they're becoming popular in multiple industries, and the inevitable security and privacy challenges they represent. So what is an RFID tag? Well, it's a very small electronic device, often the size of a seed or as thin as a piece of paper, which is capable of storing data and transmitting that data up to several meters. The reading device transmits a query signal. When the RFID tag senses the signal, it transmits the contents of its memory to the reading device. Many tags are not self-powered. Instead, they get their power from the query signal. The information received by the reading device is transmitted to a server for processing. RFID tags have two primary advantages over the ubiquitous barcode. First, RFID tags carry unique identifiers. Unlike barcodes that typically provide a general product number, RFID tags allow vendors to serialize each individual item. This allows for significant granularity in distribution control. Second, while barcodes must be read one at a time and at close range, multiple RFID tags can be read at once without any visibility to human or mechanical reading devices. In other words, no line of sight is necessary. Like all electronic processing systems, RFID is not without its privacy and security concerns. Many privacy advocates are worried about the ease and secrecy with which information is retrieved from tags. The data retrieved, they say, could be abused by the government, hackers, and retail establishments. Some of the known RFID threats include sniffing. RFID tags can be scanned without the bearer's knowledge and at significant distances. Tracking. When the use of RFID technology pervades every corner of society, it will be a simple manner to strategically locate readers to track the movement of objects, pets, and people. Spoofing. Obtaining blank tags is not difficult. Once in the possession of a criminal, authentic tags can be cloned. Cloned tags can then be used to obtain products and services with someone else's identity. Replay attacks. These can also be called man-in-the-middle attacks. Attackers can set up retransmitters to receive and broadcast queries from genuine receivers. This allows a criminal to fool digital passport readers, contactless payment systems, and building access control stations. Denial of service. Signal jamming, or devices designed to interfere with radio frequency transmissions, can hinder or block operation of RFID systems. This list represents the threats commonly associated with RFID. However, a team at the Vrije Universiteit Amsterdam successfully tested a proof-of-concept malware attack against an RFID system. Malicious code, about less than 1K, was inserted into an RFID tag. The test showed that buffer overflow, code insertion, and SQL injection attacks against RFID middleware and database servers are possible. Since RFID readers typically accept any data transmitted by tags, getting the malware to the network connected devices is relatively easy. So how do we defend against these malware attacks against our RFID systems? Well, the steps necessary to protect your information assets are similar to those you should already follow to harden your processing environment. They include bounds checking. All middleware applications written in languages that allow the use of indexes that lie outside the bounds of an array should be compiled with bounds checking enabled. Sanitize the input. Ensure the RFID input received contains data you expect. Any unusual characters, character strings, etc. should at a minimum send an alert to the system or security administrator. Disable back-end scripting languages. HTTP-based middleware can reduce the risk of script injection or cross-site scripting by turning off client-side script execution. Limit database permissions and segregate users. In addition to enforcing the principle of least privilege, database implementation shouldn't allow the execution of multiple SQL statements in a single query. Use parameter binding. It's risky business building SQL statements on the fly. Instead, access databases with stored procedures with parameter binding. Isolate the RFID middleware server. Access to the middleware server should not provide access to the rest of the network. As with any perimeter device, middleware servers should be placed in a containment zone. A DMZ is an example of a network containment area. And finally, perform regular code reviews. Like all applications, the middleware application code should be regularly reviewed to ensure vulnerabilities haven't crept in during routine maintenance or major upgrades. RFID might be a new technology, but the threats it presents to existing networks are no different than we face today. There's always someone trying to establish a beachhead from which to compromise our systems. The key is to harden our environments so that malicious code is unable to find a foothold. Okay, let's move on to our final topic, DNS cache poisoning. The internet would grind to a halt. It would not be possible without a domain name system or DNS. As you'll see in this episode, the proper operation of DNS is fundamental to the maintenance and distribution of the addresses for the vast number of nodes across the globe. So it would be too much to hope for crackers, malicious hackers, to ignore DNS as they continuously look for new ways to circumvent your security. There are several facets to DNS security. In this episode, we're going to focus on one of the most dangerous types of attack, DNS cache poisoning. To provide a complete picture of this threat, we'll explore how DNS works, two ways crackers facilitate cache poisoning, what impact this type of attack can have on your organization, and steps you can take to protect your information assets. So, what is DNS? Well, in the world of internet and TCP/IP, IP addresses are used to route packets from source to destination. A single IP address, for example, 203.192.135.234, is not difficult to remember, but trying to learn or track thousands of these addresses, including which server or node is associated with each address, is a daunting task. So instead, we use domain names to refer to systems with which we want to communicate. A real-world internet domain name example is google.com. When you enter the Google domain name into the address bar of your browser, the Google page appears. This is because your PC executed a process to resolve Google.com to an IP address. Only by having the IP address is a system able to initiate a session with another system across the internet. So let's look at two ways IP address resolution can occur. In our example, Workstation must establish a session with a server with the domain name of farpoint.company.com. In order for a Workstation to implement DNS, it must be running a DNS client or client resolver. The resolver initiates the following process, resulting in the conversion of the domain name to an IP address. Step 1. The resolver checks the resolver cache and the Workstation's memory to see if it contains an entry for farpoint.company.com. The entry would be present if the workstation had resolved the name to an IP address since the last time it was powered on, and the time to live of the entry had not been exceeded. In this example, no entry is found in the resolver cache. Step 2. Having found no entry in the resolver cache, the resolver sends a resolution query to the internal DNS server. Step 3. When the DNS server receives the query, it first checks to see if it's authoritative for the company.com domain. In other words, is it responsible for managing the zone in which the company.com domain resides? If it is, the server performs a lookup in its internal zone table. In this case, it finds a host resource record that includes the IP address for farpoint.company.com. Step 4. The IP address of farpoint.company.com is returned to the resolver. And step 5, the resolved domain name and IP address are placed into the resolver cache, and the IP address is used to contact Farpoint. In this example, the target server was located within the requester's network, but there are many cases in which the target device is located somewhere on the internet. In these cases, the process is somewhat different. Let's step through this second DNS resolution process. For the purpose of this example, the system we're trying to contact is farpoint.companya.com. Step 1. The resolver checks the resolver cache in the workstation's memory to see if it contains an entry for farpoint.companya.com. Step 2. Having found no entry in the resolver cache, the resolver sends a resolution request to the internal DNS server. Step 3. When the DNS server receives the request, it first checks to see if it's authoritative. In this case, it isn't authoritative for companya.com. The next action it takes is to check its local cache to see if an entry for farpoint.companya.com exists. It doesn't. So, in step 4, the internal DNS server begins the process of iteratively querying external DNS servers until it either resolves the domain name or it reaches a point at which is clear that the domain name entry doesn't exist. Step 4. A request is sent to one of the internet root servers. The root server returns the address of a server authoritative for the .com internet space. Step 5. A request is sent to the authoritative server for .com, the address of a DNS server authoritative for the companya.com domain is returned. Step 6. A request is sent to the authoritative server for companya.com. The IP address of farpoint.companya.com is returned. Step 7. The IP address for Farpoint is returned to the client resolver. And finally, step 8. An entry is made in the resolver cache, and a session is initiated with farpoint.companya.com. This process, from the client resolver perspective, is known as a recursive query. With the proper software, the client resolver could perform the iterative query itself, the query that was completed by the DNS server. Now that we have a good idea how DNS is supposed to work, it's time to look at how this process can be used to co-opt one or more DNS caches. DNS cache poisoning consists of changing or adding records in the resolver caches, either on the client or the server, so that a DNS query for a domain returns an IP address for an attacker's domain instead of the intended domain. So, to demonstrate how this might work, let's step through an example. Step 1. The resolver checks the resolver cache in the workstation's memory to see if it contains an entry for farpoint.companya.com. In step two, the resolver sends a resolution request to the internal DNS server since there was no entry in the resolver cache. Step three, when the DNS server receives a request, it first checks to see if it's authoritative. In this case, it isn't authoritative for companya.com. So the next action it takes is to check its local cache to see if an entry for farpoint.companya.com exists. And again, it doesn't. Now, up to this point, everything has been just fine. Everything has worked as it's supposed to. The problem in our example comes in step four, when the DNS server sends a request to one of the internet root servers to begin its iterative query of external DNS servers. In step four, a request is sent to one of the internet root servers. The root server returns the address of a server authoritative for the .com internet space. So far, so good. In step five, a request is sent to the authoritative server for .com. The address of a DNS server authoritative for the companya.com domain is returned. Also, no problem here. The problem comes in step six. A request is sent to the authoritative server for companya.com. This is identical to the standard process for an iterative query with one exception. A cracker has decided to poison the internal DNS server's cache. In order to intercept a query and return malicious information, the cracker must know the transaction ID. Once the transaction ID is known, the attacker's DNS server can respond as the authoritative server for companya.com. Although this would be a simple matter with older DNS software, for example, Bind 4 and earlier, newer DNS systems have built-in safeguards. In our example, the transaction ID used to identify each query instance is randomized, but figuring out the transaction ID is not impossible. All that's required is time. To slow the response of the real authoritative server, our cracker uses a botnet to initiate a denial of service attack. While the authoritative server struggles to deal with the attack, the attacker's DNS server has time to determine the transaction ID. Once the ID is determined, a query response is sent to the internal DNS server. But the IP address for farpoint.companya.com in the response is actually the IP address of the attacker's site. The response is placed into the server's cache. The rogue IP address for Farpoint is returned to the client resolver in step 7, and in final step, step 8, an entry is made in the resolver cache and a session is initiated with the attacker's site. At this point, both the workstation's cache and the internal DNS server's cache are poisoned. Any workstation on the internal network requesting resolution of farpoint.companya.com will receive the rogue address listed in the internal DNS server's cache. This continues until the entry is deleted. Another method used to poison a DNS cache is the use of a recursive query sent by the attacker. The query can force the target server to connect to the authoritative source of the domain in the query. Once connected, rogue information about one or more domains might be sent to the querying server and posted to the server's cache. Now we're going to explore the consequences of using a poisoned DNS cache. Farming is the primary risk associated with cache poisoning. Crackers employ farming for four primary reasons: identity theft, distribution of malware, dissemination of false information, and man-in-the-middle attacks. Once an attacker gets you to his site, he'll try to trick you into leaving behind information he can use to impersonate you or steal your identity. One way to do this in our first example is to create a site identical to the real farpoint.companya.com. When the user connects using the poisoned cache information, she might be fooled into entering information about herself through apparently legitimate requests for her name, social security number, address, or other personal information. Another objective of attackers using cache poisoning is the automatic distribution of malware. Instead of releasing malicious code into the internet and realizing random results, the use of rogue IP addresses to redirect unsuspecting users to the attacker's site can be a more focused attack vector. Once a workstation initiates a session with the malicious site, malware is uploaded to the workstation without intervention by or the knowledge of the user. Dissemination of false information is useful to attackers who want to spread self-serving information about an organization. It's also been used to manipulate stock prices in an attempt to realize a large profit. In a man-in-the-middle attack, the workstation initiates a session with the attacker's server. The attacker's server initiates a session with the actual target site. All information flowing between the workstation and the genuine site passes through and is intercepted by the cracker's server. There can be serious consequences when security is an afterthought during the configuration and deployment of DNS servers. We're next going to talk about some guidelines that can help prevent cache poisoning. The first layer of defense against cache poisoning is the use of the latest version of DNS. DNS based on BIN 9.3 or later, or Microsoft Windows Server 2003, is far more secure than DNS implemented with earlier versions. Successful implementation of our first poisoning example would have been more difficult because these systems also randomize the port used for the DNS query in addition to the transaction ID. Recursive queries should be limited to internal DNS servers. If internet-facing recursive queries are required, only queries from internal addresses should be accepted. This will help prevent outside systems from sending queries with malicious intent. The following list provides some additional guidance, and this list and the source of the list can be found at adventuresinsecurity.com/blog. The first guideline is to physically separate external and internal DNS servers. You should also restrict zone transfers to authorized devices. Use TSIG to digitally sign zone transfers and zone updates. One of the best ways to prevent poisoning is to force identification of the sending authoritative source. You should restrict dynamic DNS updates when possible. Next, you should hide the version of BIND being used on the DNS servers. Remove unnecessary services running on the DNS servers. And finally, where possible, use dedicated appliances instead of multi-purpose servers. DNS cache poisoning is a large risk for organizations running early versions of DNS solutions. Elevated risk extends to companies that carelessly deploy DNS, regardless of the DNS software version used. Careful attention to version management and the secure configuration of DNS devices should reduce risk from cache poisoning to an acceptable level. Well, that's it for this week. I hope I was able to make it a little bit easier for you to protect your information assets. I also invite you to visit our website, adventuresinsecurity.com, where you can download or view online courses that we've got up there. We have 3 courses currently, and there are many more to come as soon as I can find the time. There'll be at least one more next week. And these are courses that are suitable for use as security awareness tools, things you can present to your staff or to employees within the organization or to management to help to educate them on different facets of security. And these are free. So go ahead and help yourself. And until next week, be careful what you click.